A new biography looks at the life and times of George Mitchell. George Mitchell has had an extraordinary career of public service. He has served as a federal judge, U.S. Senator, Senate Majority Leader, peace negotiator, special envoy, and more. His life and legacy are now the subject of a new biography, Statesman, George Mitchell, and the Art of the Possible. Written by veteran Maine journalist Douglas Rooks, Statesman examines Mitchell's life and contributions in the context of his times. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the new biography with its author, Douglas Rooks. We'll learn about the important role of Ed Muskie in Mitchell's life, why Mitchell's speech during the Iran-Contra hearings changed his life, and his part in leading a U.S. Senate very different from today's. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In today's highly charged political climate, it's hard to imagine a politician who is well-respected by colleagues and the public alike, and who can build bridges between political parties. Senator George Mitchell managed to do just that throughout his career. He earned a reputation for finding common ground between people, and even between countries. Mitchell is the subject of a new biography that explores the public life of the senator from Maine. With me in our studio, Douglas Rooks, author of the book, Statesman, George Mitchell and the Art of the Possible. He's also a journalist who covers the Maine state government, the environment, education, business, and other issues. Doug, thanks for joining us today. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
As always, we want to hear from you and the audience. What do you want to know about Senator George Mitchell? Do you have a good story to share? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Doug, why did you write this book?
Well, it's been a long-time ambition of mine. I've been asked that question several times already, and it really started, I think, probably in the 80s when George Mitchell used to stop by. I'm not kidding you. He used to stop by the Kennebec Journal newsroom in Augusta. He was the only politician who ever did that, and I didn't realize at the time it was something that he started doing during his 82 Senate campaign when he desperately needed to become better known in Maine. So he would just go to newsrooms and talk to reporters and editors. It seems amazing. But he did, and he was the one member that we had great access to the entire delegation, but George Mitchell would actually make his own appointments. And that really impressed me. And then when I got to thinking about it later, when he, you know, achieved his eminence in the Senate, that this guy would make a really good book someday. And of course, at the time, I was immersed in my newspaper career, didn't think too much of it. But I did get serious about it about 2000, 2001, and I did several interviews with Senator Mitchell with an eye to writing a book. I did a treatment, did not get a publisher. So it went on the back burner until 2014, when suddenly I had a contract for the book.
Wow. You know, George Mitchell has written about his own career in several memoirs. What did you believe that you could add, having read what he had written about his own life?
Well, it's interesting looking at someone who's documented himself so well, and he is a good writer, and he's covered a lot of the different aspects of his life. I think what a biography does, writing a memoir is like composing a sonata. I think writing a biography is like having a symphony going on. You have all the other people involved with George Mitchell, his family, his old colleagues, his campaign manager, his Senate staffers, a lot of people that no one else would ever know about except for George Mitchell. And when you bring them into the picture, I think you get an interestingly different and I hope more rounded picture of him.
All right. Well, this is a very it's a long and very, you know, it's really well researched, Doug. This is quite a document. And I suspect that it will be used in classrooms as well as, you know, folks reading it out of their own curiosity. So we're only going to be able to scratch the surface today of some of the content. But one thing that's an important thread throughout the book is that Mitchell was Senate Majority Leader and a leader just in general during kind of a golden age of politics. That's really one of the theses, isn't it?
It turned out to be. And I don't think probably he knew that going in, but I think he sensed opportunity. And his timing actually was perfect. It was the last great flowering of bipartisanship up to today.
Well, it's funny because I think a lot of people don't remember those days that way, between the budget battles, the Iran-Contra affair, those days as golden days. But boy, in retrospect, retrospect's 2020, isn't it?
Well, I think the big test is, does Congress work in the sense, we tend to forget about this, but Congress is basically there to pass legislation. Do they do it or do they not? Are there budget agreements or are there not? Is there when a major bill comes up, like the immigration bill did in 2013, does it get through in some form? That stuff got through when Mitchell and Bob Dole were around, and that's really the test. The theater of politics, there's a wonderful passage where one of his foreign policy aides talks about, you know, Dole and Mitchell are out there, and they're just slamming each other on the floor, and they're hollering. They're not hollering, but they're really going at it. And he said, it's all theater. We already know how the vote's going to come out. We know the bill is going to pass. So there's always that atmosphere surrounding politics of conflict. But the test is, does it work out in the end?
When you talked to his former colleagues in the Senate, was there a theme? Was there something that people on both sides of the aisle said in common?
Well, I think there's enormous respect within the Senate of the day, and perhaps even some people who are still around now, that Mitchell was a person of great integrity. You know, the very first thing he said to Bob Dole upon being elected majority leader was, I will never surprise you. I'm never going to do that stuff where we pull a fast one and you get a bill through at midnight. You know, I won't put you in that situation. And because he was willing to do that, the privilege was extended the other way.
Well, speaking of privileges, we have on the line with us now Senator Bob Dole. Senator Dole, thank you so much for joining us on Maine Calling.
Happy to do it.
Douglas Rooks, the biographer of Senator Mitchell, was just talking about your relationship with Senator Mitchell. How would you characterize your time working with him as the leaders of your respective political parties in the Senate?
Well, first of all, we were very good friends, which I think is the basis for our leadership that we were able to provide generally across the aisle. So most, a lot of things were done with a compromise because George was willing and I was willing to try to work things out. Now, some things you couldn't work out, you just had a vote. Someone won and someone lost. But I never doubted Senator Mitchell's integrity, and I don't believe he ever doubted mine. So we trusted each other. We worked together when we could. We tried to bring people in our parties together and to work together. And generally it worked. We had a very productive time in the Senate at that time. We had, some would say, the golden years in the Senate, but because of George Mitchell and,
Senator, I had a question for you. We had a chance to talk about 2 years ago. We were gracious enough to do a phone interview. And one of the questions that I didn't ask you at the time that I'd like to ask you is, what do you think was happening back then? I mean, how do we get back to that? I mean, how do we get back to an era where politicians can actually, however much they talk about each other in public or whatever, how do they get to that point of making deals again? Because we haven't had many.
I see a little evidence. I watch the Senate more closely than the House, but I see a little evidence of bipartisanship, compromise. In fact, many of the bills that have passed the Senate have been, as I understand it, on a bipartisan basis, and that's good. I think the difference is that, you know, we had such close relationship with one another. I had many Democratic friends, and Senator Mitchell had many Republican friends, which made made it a lot easier to get things done.
Senator Dole, I'm wondering if you have a story about Senator Mitchell that you would like to share with our listeners. Is there anything the people of Maine should know about him that they do not already?
Well, I hope they know everything. His name is magic in Maine, and as it should be, because of his integrity and his leadership. And, of course, he's been a federal judge, so he's been a busy man. And for a while, we were in the same law firm. Now we're in different firms. But if he doesn't work any harder than I do, I think we're in pretty good shape.
Well,
we reached the age where we show up, and that's about it.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and taking part in our Maine Calling program today. That's former U.S. Senator Bob Dole. All the best to you, Senator Dole.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you. Doug, you got to speak to a lot of interesting people researching this book, didn't you?
I did, and many people that I never knew about. They were fascinating, and yet... And I think this is also one of the themes of doing a book about someone that you feel like you know well. I mean, I had interviewed Mitchell at least a dozen times, probably more. And yet when I went to do the book, there are all sorts of aspects of his life and career, even in the Senate, that I knew very little bit about. So it made me respect the idea that you don't really know as much as a journalist as you think you do.
Sure. What were some of the surprises? What were some of the tidbits or the stories that when you couldn't wait to sit down and write about them? You can't wait for those of us who are reading the book to pick it up and learn something that they didn't know before.
It is hard to pick one.
You can pick a couple.
Well, one that made an impression on me, too, was he was very, you'll have to get this about George Mitchell, he really denigrates himself quite a lot. I mean, some of it's in a joking way, but, you know, his rivalry with his brothers was fierce and real, and they had the better of it early on. They were the great athletes. He was not. But he tends to exaggerate how bad he actually was. He did make the varsity team at both Waterville and Bowdoin, so you couldn't have been terrible to get on those teams. However, what he said to me, and I believe this was all, I got a little bit of an interview done elsewhere, that it was only when he went into the Army that he felt he really kind of grew up quickly. He went to an intelligence school. This was at the really the darkest days of the Cold War. It was a very serious business to go, as he did, to Berlin on an intelligence assignment where he was interviewing people who were either desperate to get in or desperate to get out. And he had to make judgments about who those people were and whether they were telling the truth or not. And I think that was just kind of a revelation into how did George Mitchell develop some of those qualities as a judge, as a negotiator. And I think it started there. So that was just completely news to me. And it was a moment where I said, wow, you know, I'm starting to get deeper into what this man is all about.
I love the early on that his father subscribed to National Geographic and that he and his dad quizzed each other on the maps of the world, having no idea what's to come. Mm-hmm. How could he have imagined?
Yeah, I mean, his father's two incredible interests were railroads and geography. And Mitchell actually said several places that he doesn't know why his father picked those. But, you know, the geography thing is pretty obvious. George Mitchell is a great world traveler and diplomat. But the railroad thing came in handy, too. He got trains back to Maine, and I think it probably definitely started with his father's interest and his drilling him on, you know, which all the trains that went by their house in Waterville.
I think I knew... I think I kind of knew the importance of Ed Muskie to George Mitchell's career before reading your book, but this gives me a realization of how critically important Muskie was. George Mitchell probably wouldn't be the man we know today without Muskie.
Well, I mean, it was his first political job in 1962. Having had no obvious interest in politics, he was hired practically off the street. He wanted to go back to Maine at that point and practice law in Portland. He had graduated from Georgetown Law, and then he got this call from Don Nickel, who's been a great source for the book, by the way. Hi, Don. And he was hired mostly because he had a good family background from Waterville, and where another staffer, you know, came from. But it built from there, and it was a very unusual relationship. You rarely find two people who have become as important in our public life with that kind of relationship. You know, a mentor-pupil relationship is a tricky one. And there's often rivalry, there's often recriminations or bitterness, and you know, you really don't see any of that in this relationship. Muskie trusted Mitchell, I think, more than anyone else with his political prospects, and the favor was repaid.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We're speaking with Douglas Rooks, who is just out with a brand new biography of George Mitchell. It is called Statesman, George Mitchell and the Art of the Possible. I'm going to fast forward to the Iran-Contra hearings. And I'm looking at page 203 here, Doug, and he has just been appointed the second highest ranking member of a committee that's going to look into Iran-Contra at that point. And the quote that you have here is, "As I drove to the Capitol," Mitchell said, "I thought that this appointment would change my life for better or worse." Then he added cryptically, "It did." What did the Iran-Contra hearings do for George Mitchell's career?
Well, it really was an integral part of his career. Now, that part was probably not as predictable as some other parts. But if you look at why he became majority leader, having served only 8 years in the Senate, not very long by Senate standards, particularly in those days, and how did he do it? Well, one way was he served as chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is raising money for senators and campaigning with them and help strategize. That went very well. He elected, don't quote me on the right number, I think it was 9 or 10 new senators, and those became mostly votes for him for majority leader. But I think the other aspect that was clearly important was the Iran-Contra hearings. I mean, the Contra, the book that Bill Cohen and George Mitchell co-wrote illustrates it very well. Those hearings were becoming a disaster. I mean, they really were. I mean, it was just going all wrong from the point of view of the investigating congressional committee. And Mitchell stepped in at a critical moment and basically told Oliver North that there were other views of patriotism than his. And he gave us a talk about that, which I think is probably one of the great political addresses in Maine history. And that performance really elevated him in a way that his colleagues, I think this is in that chapter at the end of it, where Bill Cohen says that was the moment where they said, "This is our leader."
Wow. Well, we're speaking with Douglas Rooks, author of the new book about George Mitchell. We do have to take a break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella. Committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy, Casella, giving resources new life. And the Natural Resources Council of Maine. Maine people protecting the nature of Maine, now more than ever. Learn more at nrcm.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert F. Kennedy's transformation from stalwart anti-communist to liberal icon. We talk with journalist Larry Tai about his new biography of Kennedy, which includes new insights on the early part of his career when he worked for Senator Joseph McCarthy. The Kennedy family gave Tai access to private family papers. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Both Maine Public Radio and Television broadcast BBC News programming. The comprehensive global reach of the BBC's coverage and the diverse viewpoints and perspectives included complement our overall news coverage. Maine Public Television has two daily weekday broadcasts, 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening. Here on Maine Public Radio, you can hear the BBC overnights from midnight to 6, and a complete broadcast of the BBC News Hour at 9 o'clock each weekday morning. Please see mpbn.net. for our program schedules.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Public Life of George Mitchell. With me in our studio, Douglas Rooks, who is a journalist and author of a new biography about George Mitchell. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to Clyde, who is calling from Camden. Hi, Clyde. Go ahead.
My call. I want to congratulate the author on having written a tremendous book. I was in history before I went to work for Senator Mitchell and Senator Muskie, and So I've read dozens and dozens of biographies, and I'm just astounded with the depth and detail of this one. It's just I wasn't prepared for such a great book.
Clyde, this is great to talk to you. I remember we got together in Bangor, gosh, probably a couple years ago now, for a very stimulating session about politics and George Mitchell. And, you know, you are still remembered and admired by a lot of people in Maine politics. I regret that I didn't have that experience earlier. But, yeah, those were great days.
Thank you so much for calling in, Clyde. I'm going to go now to an email. This is from Pat in Bangor. She writes, George Mitchell's integrity is considered unimpeachable in Maine. Yet I don't understand his having been a lobbyist for the tobacco industry and especially the chocolate industry's attempt to avoid labeling slave trade chocolate. How does he explain his decision to lobby on the side of these industries?
I can't answer for Senator Mitchell. But I was asked at a program not too long ago whether he had any regrets. And I said, I don't know. You know, you'd have to ask him. But I do think that the incidents that the caller or the email is referring to are things that he might have done differently had he chance to do them. And they, what they are is when he left the Senate, he didn't have any definite plans. A lot of people thought he was going to be baseball commissioner. That didn't work out. A lot of people thought he was going to the Supreme Court. He turned down a seat there from Bill Clinton. So he really had a lot of he had a lot of room to move. So he went to a law firm. As Senator Dole said, they were partners for a while there at a smallish law firm, which had a lot of public interest law. So I think he went back to work thinking the rules of law applied. In other words, every client needs a lawyer. And the system works best when lawyers are not, you know, emotionally or ideologically attached to their clients. They simply provide good representation. So the chocolate one was a very early one. I think I don't know very much about the background of that. I actually came across that in a Boston Globe story. But the tobacco one, was the one that made a big impact in Maine. When people found out that George Mitchell had signed on to represent the tobacco companies, I think it was fair to say there was some shock. And like, how could he do this? Well, what happened was that this was a moment where there might have been a big federal settlement of tobacco cases. There wasn't in the end. All we got in the end were the state attorney generals, and that's where Mitchell came in. Jim Tierney, who ran for governor and was Maine attorney general, was very involved with the Association of Attorneys General. They needed a Bigfoot lawyer to actually be on the other side so they could negotiate the deal. So Mitchell agreed to represent the tobacco companies in that negotiation. I think what he forgot was after 15 years in the Senate, you are identified with the public with causes. And if you are on the other side of those causes, that's going to create some difficulty. And the interesting thing was after that case, I don't think he ever took another one in which he could be said to have those vulnerabilities.
We're going to go to Phil in Vinyl Haven. Hi, Phil. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. The Vinyl Haven Men's Book Club invited Senator Mitchell last fall to come address our group and the ladies' book group on the topic of his recent book, The Negotiator. We invited him to come in June, and he agreed, but he said he would like to address the whole town if that were possible, and so we arranged to have him address 200 or 300 people at the auditorium. And I personally have never heard a more literate speaker in my life. And I've never heard anyone as gracious and humble in addressing the inquiries of people at the gathering. He was universally applauded. And at the end of his speech, we wondered why at 84 or 85, whatever he is, with nothing else to do in his life, he couldn't run for president.
Well, Phil, I understand that Senator Mitchell is on the line with us now. So, Senator Mitchell, I'm going to give you a chance to answer Phil's question. Would you like to run for president?
Well, I thought about it at one time in my life, but I think I'm past that stage. I do want to thank Phil, who's a very gracious host. I had a wonderful day out on Vinyl Haven, meeting with the people out there. My purpose in calling is simply to thank Doug Rooks for a really outstanding job of research. He wrote the book about me, But I learned a lot of things from his book that I didn't know before. He talked to people about meetings they had with me, and he unearthed documents that I'd written way back in the Justice Department a very long time ago. So, Doug, thank you very much for your courtesy, for the hard work that you put into this, and for the kind words that you had to say about me. I really do appreciate it, and I think for me, the book is really eye-opening because I'd forgotten really a lot of things that had happened. I'd had so many meetings, so many this or that, and to have it all come back to me is a real pleasure.
It's so wonderful to hear that. I mean, you do worry. I mean, a lot of people ask me, and I ask myself, do you really want to write a biography about a living person? Because, you know, A, what are they going to think when you, you know, they can't really like all of this stuff you're writing about them. But I have to say, if I had to pick one person in Maine to do this while they were still alive, it would probably be you, because you're always so gracious and straightforward. And, you know, you do what you say you're going to do. And there's not many people in the world like that.
Doug, now that you're complete and the book is out and you're done with your formal questions for Senator Mitchell, is there something you wish you'd asked him?
Oh, gosh. You know, this was a constant dilemma because I realized George Mitchell knows more about this than anyone else. Let me just call him. But, of course, I would have made a real nuisance of myself had I actually done that. So I disciplined myself to just asking Senator Mitchell things I couldn't get anywhere else. And one of them was his student days at Bowdoin College. It was very little bit about that. So we did an additional interview in addition to the two-hour interview he was gracious enough to grant me for the book. And I felt very grateful for that, but I didn't want to overstay my welcome.
Senator Mitchell, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you didn't interrupt. Well, he didn't overstay his welcome. I was happy to talk with him at all times. As Doug recalled earlier in his conversation with you, Jennifer, we met many years ago when I used to visit all of the Maine newspapers on a regular basis and sit there for question and answer periods for quite a long period of time, and I always enjoyed my sessions, really with all of the reporters in Maine, but in particular with Doug, who was always so well-versed on the issues, and that the questions were penetrating and insightful, as I think his writing is. And, you know, I'm a human being like everybody else. I've made a lot of mistakes in my life. And Doug wrote what I think is a fair and balanced. He pointed out some things I might have done better or might not have done had I known what the outcome was going to be. But I really do appreciate his effort. I didn't mean to hog this interview, Jennifer. This is really an interview with you and Doug, so I just really wanted to call and thank him for the hard work that he put into this and the research, which is really, really stunning.
It's great to hear from you.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you, Senator Mitchell, and we look forward to having you on Maine Calling in the near future. Thank you so much.
Right. Bye-bye.
Well, that's kind of fun.
That was fun. I mean, you know, I worried about it, but like everything else about George Mitchell, there are other biographical subjects that some friends of mine have written about who have not been as easy. So I guess I did pick the right guy.
We're going to move on to Felix, who's calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead.
Hi. Geez. Can the author speak to the situation in Ireland before the treaty? Were the circumstances more like economical, religious, or... I know George Mitchell got that treaty down, and things calmed down thereafter. I'm just sorry I missed. You should have him on there to explain this, probably.
Well, he could do a great job of it. I can do an okay job of it, but I'll give it a shot. And when he went to Ireland, things seemed very dire, and they had been for a long time. I mean, the Troubles, as they're euphemistically called, have been going on in big time for more than 20 years. I mean, people daily were being kneecapped and shot on the streets of Belfast and other places in Northern Ireland. It was horrible. I mean, this was a level of violence within what we considered to be the civilized communities of the West and Europe that was really, it was horrible. I mean, people couldn't understand it from outside, but within it, it was deadlock. It was absolute deadlock between the Catholic and the Protestants and all of the many, many political parties who were attempting to represent them. So it seemed impossible, but when Mitchell went, there were actually signs, and there had been agreements between the British and the Irish governments before that that sort of led a framework for what eventually became the Good Friday Agreement. What they were lacking was a reliable, neutral, independent person to lead the talks. The British themselves had tried to do it several times, and it never worked because the Irish negotiators never trusted the British people. Surprise, surprise. Mitchell was unique in the sense that he had people could see them as one of them or maybe favoring their side. And in the end, he was the perfect person to lead those talks. But he will say himself that it was the people at those talks from the country who had to live with the agreement they signed who were the real heroes, and they're the ones who were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Felix, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'd especially love to hear it if you have a story about working with Senator Mitchell over the years. We're talking about with the biographer of Senator Mitchell, Douglas Rooks. His new biography is called Statesman, George Mitchell and the Art of the Possible. Doug, I've turned to another page, and we're talking about, I'm going to quote from a New York Times editorial that you quote, during a budget reconciliation process, and the very characteristics that deny Mr. Mitchell attention. So it's about how George Mitchell does not receive the attention as others at the time. The very characteristics that deny Mr. Mitchell attention, the control of his temper, the willingness to yield center stage, and the sometimes tedious command and explication of detail were essential to success. And it goes on, House Speaker Thomas Foley of Washington says, Mitchell has the best developed patience muscle in Washington.
You know, he talked an awful lot about that patience muscle. And you could argue it did eventually give out. He did leave the Senate for many of us rather abruptly in 1994. But yes, it was remarkable while he was there. But that I think that editorial was called The Quiet Man or something like that. And I think there's an interesting tension in politics between getting noticed and getting things done. And Mitchell, in that time, I believe, was the best at getting things done. But he didn't get noticed a lot. You know, he said he considered running for president once, and that's in the book, in 1992, he did. But you know, it wasn't an overwhelming desire of his. Most people who want to be president, it's overwhelming. And there's the tension of democracy. Do you want to have good government, or do you want to have charismatic leaders? You know, sometimes we don't actually end up with both.
All right. We're going to go, oops. I can't go to that call. Here we go. I'm going to go to John, who's calling from Orland. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for putting this on. This is fascinating, and I've been watching Mitchell through the years and through his career. An early story, though, in his career, in my career, early 80s, was when he was on the University of Maine campus in Orono, and he was going to be speaking before a group of, I think it was social workers. So it was kind of a serious time because there were some issues that involved budgeting and availability of those kinds of jobs. And he started off by putting on what would be a typical thing, a joke for the audience, you know, icebreaker. And I had a chance to meet with him afterwards. I said, do you realize that, you know, you really don't have to do that? And he said, what did I do? I think he was a very innocent guy, and you know, just so likable and so nice that he wanted to be friends with these people right away, but it was probably inappropriate to joke at that location. So I was just curious if you've run into this, if he was on a learning curve at that point in his early part of the career.
Definitely. I mean, there's a big, in fact, I'm giving a talk this week that contrasts his performance in the 74 governor's race, which of course he lost to Jim Longley, and the 82 Senate race, which he won dramatically, big comeback, and is probably the textbook case for how to win an election in Maine. So he learned a lot, and the period you're talking about could have been while he was still feeling his way. For instance, there's another section of the book that talks about his development of his humor. He was criticized a lot after the governor's race for being too serious, you know, not being able to relate to the ordinary Mainer. So while he was trying that out, it's possibly tried it out in some contexts where it was not as appropriate as others.
John, thank you so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We do have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for Douglas Rooks. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Androscoggin Bank's Main Street Foundation, now accepting applications for the 25K for Kids Award, mainstreet-foundation.org.
Perceptions of President Obama vary a lot.
I'm proud of his strength, what he's been able to convey to a nation in the face of adversity.
We have concerns with the way that the president is dividing the country.
I'm Steve Inskeep. We ask Americans how this country has changed in Obama's years. It's an NPR special report.
And that's a two-part special. You can hear part one this afternoon at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling, and part two tomorrow, Wednesday, at 2 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a biography of Senator George Mitchell. With me in our studio, Douglas Rooks, a Maine-based journalist and the author of that new biography about George Mitchell. The title is Statesman, George Mitchell and the Art of the Possible. Do you have questions about George Mitchell's life? Do you have questions for Doug about what it took to write this book? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I have a writerly question for you, Doug. I'm looking at this, and the last page of the afterword is page 532. If you had not had an editor, how long would it have been?
Well, I was pretty much self-editing at that place.
Okay.
But I knew that the original manuscript was too long, and it's still very, very long. But at some point, you just have to go with your instincts, which says, you know, if people are interested enough in reading this book, they'll read this part. And there really, at that point, wasn't anything I could have cut out. Now, maybe somebody else would have, but, you know, we have a certain pride of authorship, and nobody said, nope, it's too long. Cut it.
Did you ever at some point think, what have I gotten myself into?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Several times. I think one of the moments was I had been in the Bowdoin College Library, which is where the Mitchell papers are, most of them anyway. I had to go a few other places to get stuff. Mitchell, but a lot of it's right there in Bowdoin. And it's a very nice place to work. It's the special collections, you know, very quiet. It overlooks the quad. And I realized at some point that I had seen a complete year of the seasons going by. And I said, you know, if I don't get out of this library, I will never get this book done. And that was, I think when spring came or whatever it was, I realized, yeah, I've got to start writing now.
Okay. We have two Facebook posts to share. One from Kim Larrabee. She says, I share the author's opinion of George Mitchell and the media. I had a talk show in the 1980s, and he was a regular guest. And many, many times he stayed on the line with callers long after the show was off the air. He didn't need to, but did. And another from Facebook, Gareth Hughes, please mention the Mitchell Scholarship. My daughter went to Bowdoin on it. She's now at Google. It's not just the money, but also the support. When I've spoken with Senator Mitchell recently, he has told me the single most important thing in his life right now is the Mitchell Scholarship.
That is the last chapter in the book, and it's there for a reason, simply because, well, I mean, I liked it too, but it was so important to Senator Mitchell. I mean, he really decided after he left the Senate, this is what he wanted to do for his own state. And you will meet people all over the state who have a relative, a friend, a daughter or son who's been a Mitchell scholar, and how much that has meant to them.
We're going to go to Jeff calling from Portland. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi. As I was saying, I was a photographer documenting Senator Mitchell's 1982 campaign for his reelection and supplying photographs for his literature and things like that, and started off early in the campaign and then worked right through it to the end. Saw him, and his skill and strength as a candidate grow. But one story in particular that stayed in my mind was we were touring a Hannaford distribution plant. And then they had set time aside for the senator to do a meet and greet and work the tables where the employees were having their lunch in their cafeteria. And as he was going around through this lunchroom and people were responding very, very positively to him and saying hello, he came upon these two gentlemen were playing a game of cribbage. And I think he sort of leaned over one fellow and kind of kibitzed slightly and Sal looked up and said, "Oh, you play?" And he said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, oh, don't you sit down and have a game with me?" And he, and everybody sort of looked at each other. You know, there was this sort of little buzz, like perhaps, you know, we'll see what happens. The senator said, "Sure, I will play a game with you, but first let me finish going around the room and I'll be right back." He proceeded to move around the room, going to every table, saying hello, introducing himself, shaking hands. And by the time I got back to the cribbage players, there was this little buzz, was definitely an excitement running through the room, because the person who was going to play was apparently their champion cribbage player. And he sat down at the table, everybody gathered around, and he played a game of cribbage with this fellow and beat him by 1 point. It was so perfectly done that I couldn't tell if he intended to beat him by just enough or not. It was just enough that guy could say, "Oh, I almost beat Senator Mitchell." And the goodwill that went through the room, it was really quite remarkable. And it was at that point in the campaign, as I saw how people were responding to him personally and the personal values he brought to life, that I really felt confident he was going to win the election. And, of course, he did. But there were a lot of places where, you know, I was basically hanging out with him one-on-one or just in a car with him going from one campaign location to another. And, you know, I don't have any real direct reminiscence of any of those personal conversations.
Well, Jeff, I love the cribbage story. As you were telling it, Doug was smiling and laughing. This story does not surprise you at all, does it, Doug?
Well, as part of the campaign, absolutely not. I mean, cribbage was the one athletic competition that he could equal his brothers in. And he has played cribbage throughout his life. He's honed his game. He's used it in the Senate. And that's a great story, by the way, Jeff. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for calling. Here's an email from Mike in Gorham. "I had the honor of performing at a campaign event for George Mitchell at the Freeport home of Joe Wishcamper when Mitchell was running for Senate against David Emery in 1982. Following Mitchell's victory, I was also invited to perform at his two post-election celebration banquets in Portland and Bangor. This was 1982. What I found remarkable is that the senator greeted me by name at chance meetings for years following these three campaign events. I have heard from others that Senator Mitchell had a remarkable memory for people's names and wonder if that wonderful attribute was noted by those you interviewed for the book."
You know, it absolutely was. One of them was Paula Silsby, who was the U.S. attorney in Portland. And she had a chance meeting, I think it was a campaign stop, with her father or uncle, I think. And she was just kind of standing there watching, and she was introduced. When she decided to do an internship with him when he was U.S. attorney, he immediately told her about that incident, and she was just flabbergasted. I mean, how could he possibly remember that? And yet he does. He has an amazing memory both for names and faces and facts. I mean, you know, he can sometimes remember people's family trees better than they can.
Wow. We're going to go to Richard calling from Jonesport. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Yes, this is Richard Kampf. I'm used to get calls from Senator Mitchell's office when he was going out to places like small villages and high schools and things and invite me along. I'm the head of the Maine Solar Energy Association. And I discovered there's sort of royal invitations. I had to go. And he would always want me to talk about solar energy and such. Well, tomorrow, the University of Maine in Orono is coming down here to Jonesport with 25 young future African leaders. This is a program that Barack Obama set up in Africa that hasn't gotten much publicity, where the leaders are spending time this summer at the University of Maine in Orono. And I'm going to spend time giving a seminar where we will talk about solar energy in general, how it's done and everything, because I am a physicist that teaches this, but also about how they can think of manufacturing the photovoltaic cells and modules.
Richard, okay. I appreciate your promoting your event, but we're talking about Senator Mitchell today. Do you have a story about Senator Mitchell?
That's what I was doing. I was just saying that he was always very, very interested in renewable energy and solar energy, and was always encouraging about using it. Yeah.
All right. Well, Richard, thank you so much for your call. Apparently, we had a caller who wanted to know if Doug and myself are related. We are not. There's no nepotism here, no special favors. Doug Rooks and I first met probably 15 years ago, but as far as we know, we're not related.
Well, we had lunch, actually. I think it might have been 20 years ago. Anyway,
it might have been.
We were both working in Portland. I was working for Maine Times, and you were at WCSH. And we did get together partly to explore that question. And I think we might have some distant relatives in common in Wisconsin, where we have some family. But no, it might be no more than fifth or sixth cousin. But it is unusual to have people named Rooks. I mean, it comes
That's
up
right.
all the time.
Especially two journalists named Rooks in
yes.
the same state,
yes.
same small state. We're going to go to Anne, who is calling from Brunswick. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the author came across a time during Senator Mitchell's career where he had to deal with a Congress such as today that's very difficult in and takes such strong sides. And how did Senator Mitchell handle that time? And perhaps there might be something relevant today to try to stimulate our Congress to work better with each other and with our president.
It's a very complicated, long, I mean, so much has changed since George Mitchell was in the Senate. But I think if you were listening to the program earlier, Senator Dole said something very interesting. He's noticing some small signs of bipartisanship developing again in the Senate. Now, it'd be wonderful if that goes over to the House, because as we know, both bodies have to pass a bill before it can go to the president. But you know, I do think we've pretty much reached the limit of where we are now. George Mitchell's techniques for dealing with that were first to create a caucus position and a consensus. And you could see that on a number of important issues, such as the Gulf War resolution in 1991. That tends to get submerged after the other Iraq War that came later. But he did an amazing job of getting the caucus together into a position. And although it sounds like partisanship, it's actually something very different because it's a consensus position of those parties. If the parties both have a clear-cut, you know, position that they will support as a caucus, then they can make a deal. When you have free, you know, people all over the map, you know, senators saying the craziest things, that's not going to happen, particularly not in the Senate. So if there's one difference, it's that the caucuses themselves were better at coming up with positions that then could become a bill.
Anne, thanks for your question. Jeff in Damariscotta, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a big fan of George Mitchell, and you were talking about how he left the Senate rather abruptly, and I was just wondering his reasoning. He kind of saw the writing on the wall, what was coming down the pike, or why he left the Senate.
There are a number of explanations, and at the time, Senator Mitchell said that the personal factors did not enter it, and I think he's now more or less admitted that was not true. He was about to become engaged to his second wife, Heather, Heather McLaughlin, and he was, I think, looking at a different life for himself, which involved raising children, having a private life, none of which was very compatible with being the Senate Majority Leader. Somebody else on the staff, I think it was Tom Daschle, who was his successor as Democratic leader, said, you have almost all the responsibilities that the president does, but you don't have anywhere near the kind of support and staff. And I think Mitchell was so good at his job in a way that he made it almost impossible for himself to continue. He did say in that interview that he gave me that if he had had an option, Robert Byrd, his predecessor as Democratic leader, became appropriations chair. If there'd been a powerful chairmanship available, he said he might have just stepped over and did what Byrd did, but there wasn't anything, so he really didn't see an option. But it was a difficult moment, I think, for him and certainly for us back in Maine.
Yeah, definitely.
Thananks for your question, Jeff. We'll go to Mim, who's calling from Olna. Hi, Mim. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say that my ex-wife used to work for George Mitchell. And I'll tell you what, he was just one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. And I've been to some suppers that he was at and stuff. And then later on, he was at Bath Ironworks. Somebody was running for something. I don't remember what it was. And I walked by and I looked at him and I said, you don't know who I am, do you? And he jumped out of line and he said, I certainly do. just good people, you know. And when I found out he didn't want to run for president, I was heartbroken because I figured that would definitely be the man.
You know, it's interesting to speculate what would have happened had he done that and had he been elected. But, of course, we can't really know those things. So as a biographer, I ended up sticking to what I could find in the documents and get people to say. But it is an intriguing possibility still.
What if?
The what if? Well, Angus King, who didn't directly succeed him but now has the same seat in the Senate, talked about George Mitchell running in 2004 when it appeared that John Kerry wasn't going to be quite the candidate people wanted. And I had to admit, I didn't even think about George Mitchell at that point, but Angus King was thinking about George Mitchell.
Ma'am, thanks for your call. I'm going to ask you one more question, Doug, before we go, because you mentioned Angus King. And I'm wondering what kind of influence George Mitchell has had on the Maine delegates, both to the House and Senate, who have followed him. Have you talked to Senator King, Senator Collins, our representatives since, about what they've learned or not learned from George Mitchell?
Well, it helps plug the book because Tom Allen, former congressman, was gracious to write a little plug for me, as was Olympia Snow, who I know well. I think there was a definite influence by Mitchell on the delegation and how it conducts itself and how they relate to each other. It's a very small delegation, and when people aren't getting along, it's pretty obvious. And I think overall, despite the political strains, even today, you see more civility within the Maine delegation than in most states. But I would also add that he had some great models, too. I mean, before George Mitchell in the Senate, there was Margaret J. Smith and there was Ed Muskie. And I think they have it's a great tradition of people representing Maine in Washington as a result.
All right. Well, Douglas Rooks, congratulations and thank you for joining us today. Douglas Rooks wrote the biography Statesman: George Mitchell and the Art of the Possible. He's also a journalist who covers Maine government and other issues around the state. John Keimel ran the board today. Cindy Hahn answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the growing popularity of goat farming in Maine. And if you can wait just a little while, go to the MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. We're going to put up a terrific video produced by a couple folks at MPBN about a goat farm in Maine. It's really a wonderful way to spend your afternoon, 5 minutes of your afternoon. So I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.